Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and today we have the pleasure of speaking with Addison Wiggin, executive publisher of Agora Financial LLC, the independent economic forecasting and financial research firm he runs with Bill Bonner. Agora's wide-ranging operations include the influential econoblog The Daily Reckoning, best-selling publications such as Financial Reckoning Day, Fallout, and The New Empire of Debt, both of which Addison co-authored with Bill. These books were quite influential on me and my thinking, which is why you can find both of them in the Essential Books page at my website. Addison was executive producer and co-writer of the highly acclaimed documentary IOUSA, and if you haven't seen it, you should. It's just fantastic. So I owe a personal debt of gratitude here to Addison as well for penning the excellent foreword to my new book, The Crash Course, The Unsustainable Future of Our Economy, Energy, and the Environment. Addison, you're a man of many talents. I'm delighted to have you here today.
Well, thanks for having me, Chris. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, it's just excellent to have you. So for many years now, you've been prolific in your efforts to wake up the investing public to the risks that lie ahead. Your books, The Demise of the Dollar, Empire of Debt, Financial Reckoning Day, your movie IOUSA, which I just mentioned, all predicted a future that is increasingly now unfolding before our eyes. I'm wondering if you're experiencing some emotional conflict here, like I am. Your predictions have become soundly validated, yet that means sort of the dire outcome you feared is arriving. What's it like for you to be at this time in history?
Well, it is kind of an interesting time because we had gotten used to, for well over a decade, being mocked by people in mainstream press and even people in my own family who were sort of skeptical of the approach that we were taking to the market, which, you know, by and large looked at a mounting pile of debt at all levels of society, not just the, you know, the big fiscal problem in Washington. As we state in IOUSA, many Americans have been following the bad example set by their federal government, and they had been spending more than they take in and making up the difference on credit, and it had become a way of life. One way of saying it is that savings used to mean that you would put away some money for a rainy day, but in our consumer culture, it had become not how much you save to invest and engage in some kind of productive capacity, but how much less you were going to spend on something that you were going to buy anyway. And that entire mentality permeated our culture, really starting in the 80s, but getting worse and worse until there's a whole generation of Americans today that don't understand the very nature of capitalism, the savings and investment that led to the United States being one of the most prosperous countries the world has ever known. And a lot of the work that we put into the books, and certainly The Daily Reckoning, which is a look at the markets and what's happening in politics on a daily basis, we trace the influence of that mindset and what the likely outcome is. And when we were looking back, even right at the end of the tech wreck, 2000, 2001, 2002, the federal response, the fiscal response to a collapsing stock market just looked like it was going to create, you know, kick the can down the road a little bit and create even more problems. So we foresaw and forecasted many of the things that became big problems in the early 2000s.
Yeah, so what's a big surprise for you in this story so far? What's unfolded maybe a little differently than you thought?
You know, actually, the thing that has been most surprising to me has been the willingness with which politicians in Washington have jettisoned the very values and ideas that led us to be a prosperous society in the first place. I suspected they would do it all along, but, you know, just to give you an anecdote, in August of 2008, right before the last presidential election, we premiered IOUSA. This was before stimulus and bailouts, before trillion-dollar deficits. We had spent 2.5 years making a movie about the disastrous state of the financial balance sheet in Washington, that we were running historic deficits of what now seemed like a quaint $450 billion, and we had a mounting pile of unfunded liabilities. and we had made the movie and released it in August of 2008 for a reason. We wanted it to be part of the national conversation during the presidential campaign season. In August of 2008, we got Warren Buffett together with Pete Peterson, David Walker, the former Comptroller General. We premiered the movie, and we held a national town hall with the intention of making deficit spending and unfunded liabilities a part of the conversation that was going on in Washington prior to electing the new president. And we broadcast it on CNBC. We thought we made a big splash. Less than 6 weeks later, Lehman Brothers declared bankruptcy, and we were already on sort of the wrong course to fiscal mayhem. And after September 17, 2008, we jumped course and we got on a faster track. And I guess my biggest surprise is how quickly people were willing to engage in the amount of stimulus bailouts and deficit spending. They just kind of abandoned any kind of fiscal sense to a much greater degree than I thought was even possible.
You know, I found that surprising as well. A couple things that surprised me. First of all, how long all of this is sort of extended out, given the pressures involved. But what you're describing, we now found way after the fact that the Federal Reserve had conducted 21,000 separate transactions with places as diverse as the Bank of Bahrain and, you know, the South Korean Development Bank, among others, just mentioned in Matt Taibbi's article in Rolling Stone. And it was just surprising that just money was just thrown everywhere at this problem. And I remember Hank Paulson's dire warnings of all kinds of crazy stuff. And it was just amazing how much went out the window. And there were so few voices at that time, is my recollection, saying, hold on, wait a minute, we can actually think about this. We don't have to do this in a panic. But they didn't prevail, obviously. And so,
right, you know, even the voices that we followed for a couple of years in while filming IOUSA, David Walker principally among them, he fully supported the stimulus spending, even though we were documenting his efforts to wake people up to what was happening with the you know, with the fiscal condition of the United States. During that period, I remember we were actually going around the country and airing the film and holding Q&As afterwards at different film festivals. And one in particular was in New Hampshire at the Portsmouth Film Festival, or the New Hampshire Film Festival held in Portsmouth. Senator Judd Gregg, who was one of the more conservative voices that we put in the film, was on the stage with me during a Q&A. I think it was the day before the Senate was supposed to vote on the bailout act. He made the most ardent argument that if they didn't act soon and act with largesse, that it was going to be the end of the world as we know it. And it was just surprising to me that for all these people we've elected to put into office, and for the amount of study and intelligence that they presumably have, they rolled over and threw out all common sense and just went for it.
Well, you know, it's never a good time to tighten your belt, but I guess in an emergency, you can't even have the conversation. And we've been pretty much in, I guess, continuous emergency, even with the GDP growth that's been recorded, at least the statistical recovery. So here we are. And it's your public position that debt and our profligate indulgence is really at the root of our current economic woes here. Given what you just saw and the anecdotes you just shared with us, how do we reverse this? What do we do from this point forward?
Well, the prescription for what to do would probably come in with a lot of political baggage. It depends on where you or what form you think the government should take. Should the government play the role of providing a safety net for all citizens? Should the government be involved in providing security around the world for national interests, companies to do business in places that are otherwise hostile to us? I happen to believe we shouldn't be doing either of those things because we can't afford them. Not because politically I think that they're bad ideas, just that we've never done the hard work of figuring out how to balance those interests with the tax code that we currently run. Everything is out of whack. We can't be the policeman to the world and provide a safety net for all citizens if we don't have the tax rates or the income to the government that supports all that. It seems like common sense, and it should be common sense, but something happens when you take it from a discussion that you and I might have to the political level, which is often just driven by emotion and public speech, somehow the desire to continue promising that the government can solve all problems meets with jubilation and votes, and people want to, you know, just keep going, and they never want to actually accept that at some point unsustainable has to end. I mean, it's the nature of the word.
Yeah.
It gets kind of frustrating to even think that we're at a point where politicians are really going to have to work together to come up with solutions that are going to be unpopular to anyone. And I struggle to think that that we're even capable of putting together a set of solutions that will work. It might be too late.
Well, I share that view, and this is not just a U.S. issue. The world history and also recent current events shows that governments will reform, and they will undertake austerity, and they will live within their means when the bond markets force them to. So,
right, absolutely.
You know, Greece is in the middle of it. Portugal's in the middle of it. Ireland's right in the middle of it. You know, Spain's going to get there. The UK is trying to get there, and they haven't even had a bond market revolt yet. But boy, they have an external indebtedness problem that's off the charts. Japan's going to have to wrestle with this soon. They're trying to roll 50% of GDP in maturing debt this year, plus deal with all their other expenses related to the earthquake and Fukushima disasters and so on. So this has been my view for a long time, is that the United States will reform when the bond market forces it to. And that day will come. We just, nobody knows when or how long we can kick the can down the road. To my great surprise, pretty far is the answer to how far you can kick the can down the road. You know, but sooner or later, the bond market will revolt. And, you know, Bill Gross of PIMCO is out there saying this is coming and using scary words like Ponzi to describe our financing and so on. So we can all feel it coming. My perception is that more people that I talk to get it, that it being that there's something really broken in this story. And somehow Bernanke and the politicians are not quite there yet. They're still talking as if we can get back to happy, shiny times with no hardness. But there is clearly, and would you share this view that there is a day of reckoning here?
Well, I would definitely share that view, and I think that it does come when the government has to raise interest rates beyond what it can already afford just to get the money that it needs to continue. We witnessed a similar period in 1980 and 81 when Paul Volcker had to chase interest rates up to, I think the top was 18%. Just so that the government could attract investors. It's not unheard of, even in our own history. But when you mention that, when you talk about that, the fact that, you know, we might lose control of our ability to fund these massive deficits, in this current environment, it's met with sort of people think that you're a kook, that you don't understand something that they do understand.
Yeah.
But in fact, there will be a point where investors will look at their return from the U.S. government, and they'll say, "I want more to put my money at risk."
Yeah, and I'll date myself here, but my first home mortgage, and I think I got it in 1988, was 12.5%. People today consider that an unthinkable level, but it's not unthinkable. It happened to me not that long ago. These things come and go.
And that's closer to the historical norm, too.
Well, sure. And think about what would happen to the housing market at those rates right now. It's you know, nothing good in terms of upward price mobility. So, one of my views is that we're all speculators now. This is a strong view I have, and it starts with long-term capital management, 98. They should have let it go down and let the big banks take their lumps on that one. Didn't. So we have the moral hazard. Of course, it got multiplied by some whole number, like 10 or something. And now my perception is that everybody's speculating about what the Fed's going to do next. You know, will there be another QE or not? Is it going to be QE sort of, where the maturing MBS portfolios rolled into treasuries? Or, you know, will they wait a little while, watch some unraveling happen, and then go forward and you know, give us full QE3? What's your views on QE? And is, you know, more QE a good idea here? Or is Bernanke trapped either way?
Well, you mentioned Bill Gross. If you take his point of view, when QE2 dries up, who's going to buy treasuries then? That was the position that he took when he started unloading treasuries from PIMCO's bond funds. I think that the Fed is between a rock and a hard place, because they have to continue to be the buyer of last resort, in order to keep treasuries where they are. But they can't afford to do it. Politically, they can't afford to do it any longer. It becomes very untenable. And in fact, if they do announce a QE3, that, to me, will signal the moment when investors from around the world will start getting nervous. I think they're at the end game for what they've been trying to do. They've been trying to play both sides of the trade, keep treasuries where they are, keep the government funded, but at the same time, avoid any kind of fiscal restraint that would make treasuries a viable or even attractive investment.
Yeah, well, you know, the 10-year at what, 3.5%, 3.4, somewhere in that zone, depending on which day we're talking about, that's a pretty low rate of interest over the next 10 years, given everything that I see on the radar screen. And without the Fed stepping in there buying, influencing the prices, manipulating, whatever you want to call it, but they've been driving interest rates down. And one of the great conundrums for me is hearing Bernanke and then Yellen come out and talk about how inflation expectations are well anchored, because look at the tips to 10-year spread. You know,
it's
good, but they're buying both of them. You know,
right.
So, you know, it's just a self-referential piece of ridiculousness. So there we are, and we're all speculating now in terms of what the Fed's going to do next. But what does this future mean to investors, and what sorts of recommendations are you making to those who are looking to preserve wealth in this interesting period we're in?
Well, even now, even after all of the writing that we've done and the trends we've been following and the reasonable amount of success we've had having conversations with people, even now, the biggest recommendation we make that seems to gain the most traction is we just recommend that people recognize that this is actually happening. Most people seem to tend to think that the government is made up of a bunch of smart people who really know what's going on. Even the right readers that write back into us, they say things like, well, they wouldn't be doing this kind of thing if there wasn't a very good reason for it. There's a high degree of trust left in Bernanke's hands, in Timothy Geithner's hands. So even now, part of what our goal is just get people to recognize that this is the possibility that treasuries might not get funded the way they have in the past is a possibility. And if you take that piece out of the financial puzzle, then everything else begins to unravel very quickly. And that's why I believe we have gold going to the prices it has we've seen in recent weeks, silver, precious metals, many of the commodities, because people are looking for tangible goods outside of the financial system, things that seem to make more sense. Even though they're priced in dollars, it makes more sense to hold on to something tangible than to speculate on what treasuries are going to do or what your house is going to do. So we've been recommending, most of our editors and analysts have been doing very well in commodities and precious metals, energy markets, things that tend to benefit from eras of more intense volatility.
Sure, and I really agree with that view, in part because I don't see anywhere to hide anymore. You know, people sometimes say, well, you know, Weimar Germany or Zimbabwe, we can use these as reference points to what might happen next. But that's not true in the sense that you could always duck across a border. You know, there were four good borders around Weimar Germany that you could go across with if you could figure out how to do it and get into a sound currency. They all seem to be roughly managed the same. And so there's a point of view out there, which is that, well, you know, we're about 40 years into this fiat experiment, which is, you know, August 15th, 1971. You might date it there and say that's when we became a full floating exchange rate system with no tethering. Guess what? A lot of excess spending happened. That's historically in parallel with what we might see in other times of history. So what happens from this point forward? You know, where does big money go if it can't really escape across any borders? Or, you know, where would China go if they wanted to suddenly diversify out of $3 trillion of foreign reserves, of which, you know, maybe half is U.S.? What happens there?
Well, I think that's the big question of our era. And you mentioned that we're all speculators now. The government itself, the policymakers, people with skin in the game, they're betting that there's nowhere else to go. That's why they're pushing on a string, as the saying goes. They're betting that China, it's in China's interest to keep the jig up, because they have $3 trillion in reserves that are based on the U.S.'s ability to pay. We spend a lot of time sending our analysts around the world looking at smaller emerging markets for places that are undervalued and can get a quick kick when, like, for example, we just got back from Colombia, and a lot of the security issues in Colombia have taken place, but the market has been beaten down for so long because everyone, you know, you mentioned Colombia, they think drug wars. And So we're looking at smaller markets for our own investors because there's a kick that can happen when things return to what is considered to be normalcy. But big money, like, what does China do with their reserves? That is the question of our time, and you know, that's what I spend most of my time every day trying to figure out what's the end game here. It's going to be difficult if there is an alternative to U.S. Treasuries or the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency. And, you know, you look at monetary history or even the history of empires, as we did in Empire of Debt, every 50, 60, 70 years, there is a major shift in the reserve currency of the world, in the dominant financial structure of the world. And we're coming up on that now. And in each case, as it shifts, like from the British Empire to the U.S. Empire, as it were, there's a lot of figuring out that needs to happen, and it generally gets expressed in violence, as in wars, and in economic dislocations, like depressions. Mm-hmm. So I've been suggesting this for a long time, and I still think it's true that whatever is going to happen next, it's not going to happen without an even higher degree of uncertainty than what we've seen over the last couple of years. And, you know, the little skirmishes that we have going on in the Middle East and the two hot wars that we're involved with in Iraq and Afghanistan, I think they're just precursors to something bigger, which will accompany a shift from the U.S. as the dominant financial player in the world to something else, which will likely be some kind of sharing of financial structures with China and possibly India. And it's probably going to get a lot uglier before we get to anything that resembles peacetime and normalcy.
So we have a period of adjustment somewhere between here and there. We're going to see some sort of a fall off in living standards, I would guess, if we hold the view that the United States and other advanced economies have essentially been living beyond their means for a period of time, assuming they want their currencies to survive. That means that they'll have to live below their means for a period of time. And that's you see disruption, volatility. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I do think a reduction in our expectations of our standard of living is inevitable. Even in my own lifetime, we've come to expect more in our lives immediately on credit, and that credit card, I think, is just running out. It's a natural extension of all the trends that are in place right now, and people have grown to expect things that even a generation ago just wouldn't even be considered possible. So I think we can expect a downward revision of expectations.
In part of that expectation process, we're seeing get readjusted right now, where pension funds are getting to the table and saying, hey, maybe we can't let you retire on full benefits after 20 years of working. You're only 45. Maybe we have to extend that out to 25. Eventually, I think we'll adjust this back to probably where it was when my grandparents were working. It was just a very different set of expectations. And since you've read the Crash Course, you know that the sort of the core of that philosophy for me is centered around the idea of peak oil and the role of oil in making our economy grow and move. 95% of everything moves because of oil. You know, we can't move stuff with solar electrons yet at this point in time. And I think that we're going to experience an incredibly hard time of trying to grow our economy without the fuel of growth itself. And so, that's even under the best of circumstances, we'll probably just stabilize. What happens to the world as you see it? What happens to all these bonds that are outstanding, to focus it down? in a world without growth?
Well, there's two things. One, the first thing is that with the health of the federal government, and then by extension state and local governments, because the federal government has been supporting them since 2008, the predominant view is that the economy has to grow in order for the deficit spending to go away, for any kind of solution to the unfunded liabilities of entitlement programs to go away. The people that we interviewed for IOUSA came up with the, we'll just grow our way out of this. That seems to be the mantra of most of the people that are addressing the issue. In a world without growth, if you take the peak oil scenario, and that would require a huge adjustment in the economy too, moving from oil as the driver of the economy to basket of alternatives, that in itself is going to revise expectations, to use that phrase again.
Mm-hmm.
If there's going to be an adjustment period there that will require no growth or even negative growth, and we've come to believe that 2 or 3% GDP growth is not only desirable but normal. In order to fix any of the kind of fiscal challenges that we have, we need to see 8 to 10% growth. We need to see growth that is historically an anomaly in places like China and India, which are building out their infrastructure. So I think that if you take the peak oil thesis seriously, then our fiscal challenge gets that much more difficult. And a lot of the things that we've been talking about today become even more pronounced.
Yeah, I'm a big believer in diversifying and spreading our bets in my portfolio and for people I work with. One of the things that I noticed, though, is that our country in the U.S. here has not diversified or spread its bets around with energy. We have one bet on the table, which is we have continued access to relatively cheap oil, or abundant, or both, hopefully. That's it. That's our plan right now. The $8 billion for a high-speed rail that's going to link two towns in California, just not credible in terms of the scale of the problem here at this stage, if you believe this thesis, right? And so to me, prudent adults should be able to look at this thesis and say, wow, there's a lot of data here. It's not, opinions. It's not beliefs. There's real facts. And we can look at these facts and say, oh, there's something to this. And it's not just a couple of cranks in the internet anymore. Fatih Birol of the IEA is out saying, whoa, we're going to have supply problems here really soon. And if the world economy lurches forward at 5% next year, we don't know where this oil is going to come from. It's not 20 years down the road. It's next year. And, maybe we'll drill more and do other things or the tar sands will really get ramped up. But it hasn't been done yet. And so to me, it feels like we have a completely undiversified portfolio in this country around this prospect that we've just been talking about. And to me, it's just an incredibly huge risk for a traditionally structured portfolio, but it also has enormous opportunities for people who can see some of this coming.
Yeah, I would agree. And we have a newsletter called Outstanding Investments, and the editor, Byron King, is one of the more outspoken voices on peak oil. Predominantly, the investment advice we give in that newsletter is dislocations in the oil market itself, because there's still money to be made when the price of oil continues to rise, but also looking for alternatives in geothermal, wind, tide, things of that nature. And Byron has been very successful in a back-end product we call Energy and Scarcity Investor, in which he is looking at the very scenario that you're talking about, helping people position themselves to take advantage of the marketplace that is growing up around the peak oil thesis and the alternatives that are being rapidly developed in the meantime.
Yeah, this is a big story of mine, is that this is a period of change. Many people choose to look at the message and say, oh that's unpleasant or something, but it just happens to be reality to me. And with change, there's always crisis, but there's always opportunity. Lots of opportunities out there. We'll be doing things substantially differently in some areas in the future. When I look at the future, I say, here's what we're going to stop doing. Here's what we're going to have to start doing. Here's what we'll continue doing. And just sort of, getting the big sweeps of that correct, I think is the best thing to do. Gold and silver in 2002 is when I first started legging in. To me, it was just obvious that there was a probably a decade in front of that. You know, something, some big long sweep. You know, don't handle it. It's not a portfolio to touch. Just set it aside. That was my Rip Van Winkle move. I'm not quite clear on what that move is today, but certainly we need people out analyzing and surfing this, because it's just my view. It's a very turbulent period. Probably that's going to increase, and staying ahead of that is a full time job.
Right, and one of the central tenets of Agora Financial. The Agora Financial strategy is that while we identify a lot of the problems that are arising, in many ways, mass approach to government, mass approach to the auto industry, for example, those are all artifacts of the 20th century. And as we move into the 21st century, the opportunities become smaller and smaller, in my opinion. And therefore, if you're an investor and more nimble, you can take advantage of them. And in a way, it's a positive thing that some of these archaic, massive, archaic, you know, government structures are crumbling and meeting their demise, because that allows for people to become more nimble and take advantage of opportunities that would otherwise be swallowed up.
Oh, I completely agree. I'm wondering if I've heard you're working on another documentary set for release later this year. Does any of this tie in, and can you tell us a little about it?
It does. It ties in, absolutely ties in, because as we were making our USA, and I kept hearing this mantra, we're going to grow our way out of this, as if there was one-size-fits-all solution to the fiscal. I was mostly just looking at the fiscal problems of the federal government. But I kept hearing this, and it just made me think, well, who are going to be the people that that help us grow our way out of this? And predominantly that's entrepreneurs. Most job creation, most new ideas, most innovation comes from entrepreneurs who are willing to take a risk with their own time, with their own money, a lot of times without government help, sometimes with grants. But I wanted to look and see what those people, what entrepreneurs were thinking and doing in the post-crisis time, you know, 2008, 2009. And for a case study, I'm using this company called Odyssey Marine that looks for gold at the bottom of the ocean. I like the metaphor of Greg Stamm and his crew going out into the ocean and using very sophisticated technology that they had to develop themselves, looking for gold at the bottom of the ocean in these shipwrecks. They have to have historians and oceanographers and people that understand how tides work, and it's a very sophisticated enterprise. And they found, in 2007, they found $500 million worth of silver and gold coins at the bottom of the ocean off the coast of Gibraltar, and they were immediately arrested by the Spanish government, hauled into Gibraltar, and now, even to this day, they're in court trying to figure out. In fact, they haven't even made it to court yet, because the U.S. District Court down in Tampa, where Odyssey Marine is based, has refused to hear the case, but they've been tied up in all this time in all this kind of political shenanigans. So to me, the story of Odyssey Marine is a good metaphor for the types of challenges that entrepreneurs across the economy have faced since the housing bubble collapsed and everybody realized that housing and house prices and stocks don't go up forever. There has to be something else, moving in the economy in order for prosperity to take place.
I've been thinking on this theme in a slightly different direction, which is that, you know, if you really want to dig out from a bunch of debt and you want to grow your way out, you need something transformative, typically, you know, railroads at one point, steam engines at one point, maybe the internet at another, but something. And I've just been wondering, where is that technology? Because I don't see it right now. You know, we're doing incremental improvements. iPhone 4 is awesome, but not that much greater than iPhone 3. Et cetera and so forth. So we're everybody's like poised and ready and waiting for that transformation to come. I don't know what it is at this stage. It could be, to me, it could be in alternative technologies around alternative energy. It could be in transforming our society away from liquid fuels based on petroleum to something else, possibly, like you said, a basket of things. But we're not doing it yet. And so the longer we wait, the more concerned I become that what I think you're chronicling in this new documentary is really just governments sort of leaning on entrepreneurs saying, can we squeeze this rock a little harder?
Well, they're doing even more than that. The president got all the members of the Chamber of Commerce in a room and said, get in the game. I mean, they're trying to force them to unlock the vault and just put money back into the economy. But they're, you know, most corporations and larger players are reticent to do that right now because the environment is just too uncertain with all the different kind of political trends that are at play. But we do address that in the film. One area that is also a potential transformative area, we look at the work that Juan Enriquez has been doing in turning algae into methane. Juan Enriquez is a venture capitalist based out of Boston who helped to put together the financing for decoding of the genome, and his big idea is that the thing that sort of saved the U.S. economy in the 1990s was the movement from analog into digital. We transformed almost every industry into a digital industry in a very short period of time, and it created a lot of jobs. It created a lot of new ways of thinking. It created new areas of innovation, and it spurred on an era of enhanced computational abilities, which is now giving us the ability to solve even greater problems at a faster speed. Juan Enriquez believes that the next phase that we're going to see is a transformation from digital to life sciences. They can now program genetic code and come up with all new ways of producing things that are synthetic strands of code, and there are amazing things that they can do. Right now they're experimenting with programming the genetic code of algae to produce methane, harvesting the methane and using that as an alternative energy. Craig Venter is in that enterprise, and it's been advertised widely on Exxon commercials on TV because they dumped a bunch of money in there. But that's just one example of the kind of transformative things going on. We have a newsletter called Breakthrough Technologies, edited by a gentleman named Patrick Cox, who has been around in these transformative fields for many, many years, for 25 years, looking at companies that are coming up with all new interesting ways of solving base problems of society. And that, from our perspective, that whole area of transformative technologies is potentially the greatest source of new companies and entirely new economies. If we're going to reinvent ourselves once again, it's likely to come from that area, and that's where we're looking most deeply for investment ideas. But also, the knock-on effect would be that the economy might be able to grow and produce the kind of income that we need to address the other issues. Although I have to say that Patrick takes a much more dire look at, you know, what we would call the welfare state. He thinks it can't sustain itself the way it is, and it's likely just to get destroyed in the next wave of transformative evolution. And that's a good thing, in his opinion. Let's get rid of that old archaic way of looking at things and get on to the business of producing new products, new ideas, new innovations that can actually help people.
I'm a huge fan of whatever role technology can play, and the industries you've just mentioned, though, are very capital intensive. So we get back to this whole idea of savings and investment. You know, so my big wish here is that we can transform the narrative around what's really important, what our priorities are, maybe shift away from just mindless growth back into, like, where are we investing? Where are we investing in the future? Because there is a transformation coming, and I would like it to be one that we shape rather than one that shapes us, you know, not in a good way. So this is just fascinating. And for listeners who are interested in learning more about you, about your work, about the various analysts that you've mentioned so far, and other resources provided by Agora, where would they go?
Well, agorafinancial.com is one source. You can get, we have all of our free products on that page. 5-minute forecast is something that I write daily, and we look at the news cycle more or less and try to pass it through the lens of the different trends that we see at play, and then distill it down into a 5-minute read. It's kind of a challenge each day, but it's fun, and it helps us sort of keep on task. There's a lot of things going on, and we're trying to apply these big picture ideas that you and I have been talking about. You know, we're picking up pieces of evidence that this might be going on, or that, you know, this transformation might be happening, or even in a critical sense that, you know, we're analyzing the efforts to balance the budget in Washington, things like that. That's one important resource. Another one is the Daily Reckoning you mentioned at the beginning of the program. Bill Bonner and I founded the Daily Reckoning 10 years ago. And our effort at the beginning was simply looking at things that were going on in the stock market during the tech wreck and just kind of poking fun at the valuations that people were willing to pay for different stocks. It was a lighthearted attempt to put this this idea of saving, investing into context of what had become just a casino culture on Wall Street. The Daily Reckoning has gone through many iterations now that we've gone through 9/11, the housing bubble and bust, and other things. If you want to sign up for the Daily Reckoning, it's simple, www.dailyreckoning.com. It's free, and most of the writers that write for Agora Financial are featured there on a daily basis.
Excellent. Well, I really want to thank you again for writing the forward to my book and for being with us today. And I just wish you all the best and hope we can do this again sometime.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. This was a good chat.
Thank you. The pleasure's all mine, and I'm sure people are going to enjoy it.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.